Last week we looked at the first half of this beautiful group of statements from the exile period by the group I'm calling the Isaiah School. So that was chapter 40 to 48. Introducing chapter 49 to 55, which concludes this lovely material written, I suggest, by the Isaiah school, who are like the temple singers. And when you read it, you could be reading Psalms. And it's the same style, the same cadence, the same music. So I think there's no temple anymore, and the same people who would be writing Psalms for the temple are writing Psalms for the community gathered in the synagogues in exile. And up till now, they've been promising them hope with Cyrus. You did that last week, coming because they can see it all happening, and they're promising we're going to have a second Exodus. It's very exciting and very welcoming of the people. However, from the opening words of chapter 49 of Isaiah, it's clear that there's been a significant shift of focus. Two things have happened. The first is that Cyrus didn't live up to the expectations that the composers of Isaiah 40, 48 had of him. Disappointment. Though Cyrus conquered the Babylonian Empire, Judah is still devastated, Jerusalem, its temple, are still in ruins. Well, that's expected. And the second is, partly a consequence of this, the doubts already expressed by the community, which we saw last week. They're trying to persuade the community, and the community is pretty well saying, oh yeah, ho-hum. Bit like Sunday Mass, really. No, they're kind of not sure that the preachers have got the right thing, and they're getting on with their life, and that's fair enough. So now these have hardened, it's clear from now on, they've hardened into rejection. The Isaiah school are being not only just now treated with a bit of if and buts, but they're being ignored and rejected. They're saying you got it wrong. Yet, still introducing, the prophet preachers remain convinced, as we'll see today, that it's Yahweh's will to bring about the return of the exiles and to build up Judah so that the people can carry out the mission that they've inherited from Abraham and Jacob. Already made the point last week, it'll become clear again this week, that it's when they're stuck there on the hill, the backwater really of Jerusalem and Judah and desert and hill country, and they're not on any of the main trade routes, so it's all a bit of a back thing. Now they're thrust in there with all these other nations too, who are also in Babylon for the same reasons, and the big empire and trade and money going here and science and a bit of physics starting and mathematics, and it's pretty of an exciting world to them, and a bigger language, Aramaic. They're realising that they've got a mission, because these people with all their wonderful culture are still so stupid religiously. The Jews see. They've got gods that will see, have ears and cannot hear, bits of wood, and they think, oh my God, how could you be so stupid, really, from a religious point of view? We're having all this other stuff. So they're convinced that they've got and it heightened their mission, and then they reread, you know, their stuff, or rethought about Abraham, the father of many nations. Wow, many nations. And when they thought about God, they're going to be the stars of the heavens, and they got an outreach which they're aware of, really for the first time. So they see it as Yahweh's will to bring about the return of exiles and to build up Judah so that the people can carry out that mission, to reveal Yahweh to the nations. And we'll see plenty of that here this morning. The nations are awaiting the Torah. Since the people are not in a position yet to do this, they're exiles in Babylon, and since they're no longer listening to the prophetic message, they're not turning up, the members of this exile school realize that it's they wanted the people to be the servants of Yahweh. Now they realize we better do it. We, this inner group, as it were, because the people are not going to pick it up. They've got to keep the flame burning and carry out the mission given to Israel. They must, in that sense, be Israel. Their opening words then, which we're going to look at in a moment, are no longer addressed to the people of Judah, whether in Jerusalem or in exile. They're addressed to the nations. And that's new from chapter 40 to 48. It's Yahweh's will for the nations to come to know Yahweh and experience freedom and salvation through following the way of the Torah, the way Yahweh revealed to Israel, the way that has its source in communion with God, with Yahweh, and flows into a world order characterized by justice, the great theme of Isaiah ben Amoz 200 years earlier. Karl Stuhlmüller, who's a Passionist priest, an American, died some years ago, and he's written a little book called New Paths Through the Old Testament. And on page 99, he makes this statement, and I've just changed it a bit to, we shouldn't be doing that, but you'll see why I've done it in italics. Instead of saying prophet, because he was working from the assumption that I used to work from too, that you've got a Deutero-Isaiah, an anonymous prophet in exile that's accounting for this material. And if you follow that opinion, stay with Stuhlmüller and talk about the prophet. I'm, however, talking about the prophet preachers, the school of Isaiah. So whichever you take your pick, I mean, but so therefore I've just altered his words to keep it consistent with what I've been teaching. And he writes, a somber sadness now muffles the enthusiasm of chapter 40 to 48. The people couldn't believe that God's compassion would reach this tenderly to the ends of the earth. Nor could the people accept the price of sharing the covenant and its God with other nations. Hate your enemies. You know, that this is us. We're the privileged people. Worst of all, he continues, the prophet preachers acclaimed the Persian Cyrus as another Moses. Back in 44 to 45, we saw that last week. Such openness clashed with the narrow prejudice of the people. Brackets. Jesus had the same problem, reaching out to Samaritans, saying that the vineyard will be taken from you and given to a people who'll bear its fruit. Open-minded people find it hard in a narrow little world. Such openness clashed with the narrow prejudice of the people, he says. The prophet preachers were spurned, publicly humiliated, and cast aside. In the solitary darkness, they saw themselves reliving the history of their people in their dreadful suffering. They also sustained hopes beyond despair, life beyond death, absorbed from the tradition of Moses and the earlier prophets. So in that mood, I hope that's clear as a background, we'll now start reading the text, and maybe you'll read it with your eyes washed a bit and a bit more enlightened to see. So the text 49 verse 1 reads, listen to me, O coastlands. See, universal. Pay attention, you people from far away. Yahweh called me before I was born. While I was in my mother's womb, he named me. The me now, I'm suggesting, is the Isaiah school. He made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand he hid me. He made me a sharpened arrow. In his quiver he hid me away. This instrument of God to penetrate and to pursue the mission of God and this little missionary group. And he said to me, you are my servant. You this group in exile who've got the message and have been pushed aside, and you might say like a religious order kind of thing. You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. But I said, I've laboured in vain. Chapter 40 to 48. Been talking to years to these people, telling them what to do, but no one's taking any notice. I've spent my strength for nothing. Vanity. It's got nowhere. Yet surely my cause is with Yahweh, and my reward with my God. So you see what I'm suggesting to you? The my here is a group, self-aware group, that are communicating with the nations and in prayer talking about their relationship with God. And now Yahweh says, still chapter 49, Yahweh who formed me in the womb to be his servant and bring Jacob back to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him, for I am honoured in the sight of Yahweh, and my God has become my strength. He says, is it too light a thing that you should be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to restore the survivors of Israel? So that's your job. You've been trying to do that, I know, but keep trying, keep doing it. You've got to carry on this mission. I'll give you as a light to the nations. See the missionary thing now. That my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. So you've got to, if my take on it is correct, and of course I'm following, well, you've just seen Karl Sturmuhl, and I could give you plenty of other references to the scholars who are suggesting that you're talking about the psyche of this group who see themselves having this universal mission. I will give you as a light to the nations, my salvation will reach to the end of the earth. If you read Paul's speech in Acts 13, he quotes that. Because he too, the Christian, just to jump, the Jewish Christian group in the early, or the middle of the first century, identified with this. Because they too, Paul was pushed out by the Pharisees and didn't get too many, and the Jewish Christian group is quite a small group comparative to Judaism. And they've been, Stephen was martyred, and you know the story, and they were being handed over to the Roman authorities, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. So they're a persecuted minority group, but they've got a mission to do, and Paul's not going to pull out of it. And they, thank God, the Jewish Christian community held to it, otherwise we wouldn't be here today, because they were so in love with what they'd seen. And they knew they'd seen it, and were convinced by it. And the fact that other people couldn't see it, well, other people couldn't see it, but they're not going to... Well, there it is. I'll give you as a light to the nations. My salvation is reaching to the ends of the earth. Paul identified with it. Back to Isaiah. Thus says Yahweh, the Redeemer, we met that word last week, the Redeemer of Israel, and the Holy One, a real Isaiah term, to one deeply despised and abhorred by the nations, the slave of rulers. And this is what he says. Kings shall see and stand up, princes, and they shall prostrate themselves because of Yahweh, who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel, who has chosen you. Your mission will penetrate to the ends of the earth. So keep hold of it. They, the Isaiah school, are called to be faithful Israel, God's chosen people. And I'm referring you back to some of the stuff we saw last week. Thus says Yahweh, in a time of favour I have answered you. On a day of salvation I have helped you. I've kept you. I've given you as a covenant to the people, to establish the land, to apportion the desolate heritages. Continuing chapter 49, saying to the prisoners, come out. That's real Jesus stuff, isn't it? Remember, he goes into the synagogue in chapter 4 of Luke and opens up the scroll and picks Isaiah, not this passage, but another passage, about being a light to the nations and bringing prisoners out of. And the prisons he's talking about are us. We're all a bit, you can be imprisoned by your theology, by your family, by your background, by the culture we're in that's got its blind spots and we don't even see them. And we just get into the air you breathe in is the air that's in your lungs. So we're breathing it in all the time, so no doubt it affects us. And it's hard to see through it. Well, come out, is what these people are saying to their own contemporaries. To those in the darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed along the ways. On all the bare heights shall be their pastures. They shall not hunger or thirst. Neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them down. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by springs of water he will guide them. The Lord is my shepherd. You've got the similarity images. And this lovely word here, which is raham, rahamim, the noun, pity, this lovely word, it's about feelings. It's a feeling word. And I think I've said to you so often before that rechem in Hebrew means the womb. So it's an actual, only you mums who've had kids will understand it. The rest of us do our best. The feeling you have for the child in your womb, that kind of affection and dreaming and hope at the best times. In the other times you'd have other feelings, I imagine, of exhaustion and so on. But I'm talking about that dreams that you have for your children when they're in the womb and the protection and the care and the nurturing, all of that. Well, that's like God is nurturing us like a mother and bringing us by springs of water. Yahweh has comforted his people. Very opening words of chapter 40. Comfort, comfort my people. And he will have compassion, same word again, on his afflicted ones. You, the group of Isaiah prophet preachers who are being ostracized from the community because you're daring to invite them to come back and promising them a mission when they've settled down and are quite happy just to get their insurance when they retire and hope there won't be another world collapse and then they can play golf maybe or become a sacristan at the local church. And we continue the chapter. But Zion says, I've left a couple of dots here because I can't read the whole thing. Zion says, Yahweh has forsaken me. The Lord, Adonai, has forgotten me. That's what they're saying. And the answer is, can a woman forget her unweaned child? Or show no compassion for the child of her womb? Good reply. Well, even if these should forget, maybe it's possible, but highly unlikely, but even if they would, I will not forget you, says God. I've carved you, inscribed you on the palms of my hand. So it's there, written down. Some of these kids still do that, don't they, at school?
Yeah.
Write all their notes on the back of there. Well, this is kind of cut into the hand. It's more than a tattoo. And your walls are continually before me, the city walls. But God loves Jerusalem and loves the people and can't forget them because every time he opens his hand, there they are. Yahweh is always attending to his design for the rebuilding of Jerusalem, as they see it. And not just with his eyes, but with his hands, for he's actively engaged in seeing that the rebuilding goes ahead. That's why the hand is used here. It's the action, not just thought. Isaiah 49:17-22, which I'm leaving out. Jerusalem will be surprised and delighted at the number of children that pour in from exile. Read it for yourselves. And then it goes on in chapter 23. Then you will know that I am Yahweh. Those who wait for me will not be put to shame. Chapter 50, verses 7 to 9, I'm selecting a little bit, have to. The prophet preaches, I suggest to you, are mocked. And it's not surprising that when we come to the New Testament, and this part of Isaiah, these chapters 40 to 55, is the most quoted and alluded to section in the New Testament. This is where they get a lot of their language from. Well, of course, when Jesus gets mocked, can't you see why they would go back to the language of Isaiah and try and join the dots for their contemporaries who read that and looked at that and thought he was a heretic and that's what they should believe? And they're saying, no, connect the dots. Jesus is the fulfillment of this. He's going through what we went through in his pain. It's not in a rejection by God. God is, the Lord Yahweh helps me. Oh, did I go too fast or something? There, I've got him back the front. I'll fix it up for tonight. Chapter 50, verse 4 to 6. The Lord Yahweh has given me the tongue of a disciple, that I may know how to sustain the weary with a word. Morning by morning he wakens my ear to listen as a disciple listens. The Lord Yahweh has opened my ear. I, for my part, was not rebellious, nor did I draw back. I gave my back to those who struck me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting. I'm suggesting to you that this group have been very badly treated by the community, rejected and so on. And that they're talking about themselves now. But when we get to the New Testament, of course, we can't but think of Jesus in the trial and so on. According to the Martyrium Isaiae, which is from the last third of the first century AD, this is a book, a story, Isaiah ben Amos died as a martyr. That's the tradition of the Jewish tradition. Sawn in two under King Manasseh. And you can find that referred to in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 13, and in the Mishnah. The authors identify with him in their prophetic spirit. So let us, for the moment, assume, because we can't do much else, assume that that's a memory that's come down in the oral tradition. I can only assume that. I'm not saying it's true. But if it is that, and that's what the people writing this understood, I'm making a couple of jumps there, but it's possible, then they see themselves as the Isaiah school of suffering the same kind of rejection as Isaiah suffered martyrdom for. They're kind of martyrs for the cause. And so they're using this language of rejection for them. And then the New Testament will apply it to Jesus. Oh. Chapter 50, verse 7. The Lord Yahweh helps me. Therefore I have not been disgraced. I have set my face like flint. They're determined. They're going to carry on. And I'm referring you there to, it's not a quote, but you remember Jesus is rejected in Samaria and it says he set his face towards Jerusalem. Like he's not going to. And that's quite near that, I think. I've just forgotten the verses now, but you remember that strange passage where the Pharisees come up to Jesus in Galilee and say, look, get out of here. They say, Herod's going to, he's after you, because he killed John the Baptist, so he's after you. And Jesus says, tell that fox, Herod. So he didn't mix words. Tell that fox, Herod. And this is quite an interesting text. Today, tomorrow, and the next day, I continue my course. I'm not going to stop because of Herod. Today, tomorrow, and the next day, I continue my course, and on the third day, I will achieve my end. And all you brilliant people can tell something in there. That's interesting. The third day is not the same as the day after tomorrow. Today, tomorrow, and the next day, well, you might think that's the third day, wouldn't you? You could. Today, tomorrow, and the next day, I'm on my journey and I'm not going to stop. And on the third day, I'll achieve my end. No, he's got a couple of year and a half to go yet. So it's another indication that the third, when we read the expression the third day, we've got to stop thinking chronologically. We've got to think, we've got to go back to the book of Exodus. It's the day of the revelation. It's the day when God, it's a term used for the day when God reveals who God is on the mountain. On the third day I will come down on the mountain and I will reveal, etc. So when Jesus, or when the expression in the New Testament is used by Jesus or others about the third day, it means the day of when we see what really is. Whether it's a million years' time or tomorrow is irrelevant. It's not a time statement. So I'm sorry, come back to this. But anyhow, the text I'm using is where Jesus sets his face like flint. He's going to go to Jerusalem. And we're all got to do that, do what we have to do, whatever the consequences. Or to the extent we can't do that, we're still not free, are we? Was it Martin Luther King said, until you're willing to face death, you can't begin to live. Because you've always got a price. You've always can be bought or you can be held back because your fear of death will stop you being who you are, and people can threaten you with death and take away your soul, your spirit, because you think, oh, I can't die. But I don't know, we've got to get to the stage where, come hell or high water, we're going to be who we are, and death is not a threat that's going to change us. It'd be good to be like that, wouldn't it? I mean, I feel like that at the moment because no one's threatening me. But if they were, I might suddenly find I don't really have this such a strong conviction, because you don't know till you're there, do you? All right. I know that I shall not be put to shame. He who vindicates me is near. Who dares bring an accusation against me? Let's confront each other. Who are my adversaries? Let them confront me. Remember Paul? Who's against me? Life, death, princes, principalities, the future, the past. None of that is of interest to me because of Christ Jesus, my Lord. So, if God is for me, who is against me, says Paul. It's the Lord Yahweh who helps me. Who then will declare me guilty? All of them will wear out like a garment. The moth will eat them up. So this group is quite strongly determined, thank God, to carry on their message. And we're going to go deeper into that after the break, and then next week after the exile. We see they're the hope, really, because just about everybody else in Judah is petty-minded, legalistic, stuck in the mud, all of that stuff. But this group kept speaking out against the narrowness of their contemporaries. And we've just got to keep people alive who keep doing this. Note the absence of any call for vengeance. Suffering abuse because of obedience to the prophetic commission, they're confident in Yahweh's support. But they're not getting caught up in the reaction to their contemporaries and saying, well, blow them, we'll... They're not sending in the troops. They're confident that if they stay where they are, God will support them. Isaiah 50 verse 10 now. Who among you fears Yahweh and obeys the voice of his servant? His servant means this group, I think. Who walks in darkness and has no light, yet trusts in the name of Yahweh and relies on his God. I'm not doing much by applying that to me or you. I don't think I need to apply. But like this, those few verses are quite beautiful for us, aren't they? Personally, I mean, and to be walking in darkness with no light and still trust in Yahweh is what Jesus did in the garden and on the cross, and what we're all called to do at certain times of our life. Then there's a bit of a jump, and I'll read to you Isaiah 51, verse 9 to 11. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. And here we have a reference back, I did it with you last week, I can't do it again, to the Enuma Elish, you know, the Babylonian myth about the creation from the gods, in which Marduk slayed Tiamat and then creation came and all that stuff. So was it not you, Yahweh, who cut Rahab in pieces? Well, this is mythical language. God didn't come down with a penknife and cut a crocodile to pieces, or a god of crocodiles or anything. It's not like that, is it? But it's saying it was you who did. There, all these silly people in Babylon think Marduk. And Marduk, have you ever seen Marduk? Marduk is about that high and he's made of wood and he's got eyes that can't see and hands, and they trundle him on the back of a thing and take him out to the temple. And when the carriage thinks Marduk falls out, so they have to pick him up and put him back in again and tie him in. Well, that's what their god is. For God's sake, these people say, what are they doing? It was you who did this. So they're using the same language. Who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep? Tehom, which is Tiamat. The Hebrew Tehom, the Babylonian Tiamat. That's the story, the great deep. Tohu Vabohu in the Hebrew. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the Spirit of God hovered over the deep. Oh, God, I can't even remember Genesis chapter 1, but you with me? You know the scene. And the waters, the chaos of the waters. And God was the one who dried it up and brought land revealed in the middle of all this and separated this. You're the one. You who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to cross over. Red Sea, Jordan. So the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with singing. If we could come all the way from Egypt to the promised land, and if we could cross over from Moab into the thing, surely we can go back from Babylon across the desert to home. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Verse 16, I've put my words in your mouth, my words in your mouth, prophecy. I've hidden you in the shadow of my hand, or the shade of my hand might be better. Shadow tends to have a bit of a negative, or maybe it doesn't for you, a little bit of a negative nuance. Shade doesn't. Shade is, I think, a better translation. Remember in the Annunciation, the Holy Spirit will overshadow you. Better, no, the Holy Spirit is like the shade in the desert. See, it's a desert image. Come as shade, like a tabernacle, like a tent, from the heat of the day and the love that's there and all that. So, here, they've hidden you in the shade of my hand, stretching out the heavens and laying the foundations of the earth and saying to Zion, you are my people. Then it goes on to talk about the Jerusalem being destroyed and the relief is coming. And I'll go quickly to chapter 52 now. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For the uncircumcised and the unclean shall enter you no more. Uncircumcised, unclean. Assyrians, Babylonians, you get it? People who are not pure, kosher. Shake yourself from the dust. Rise up, ascend your throne, Jerusalem. Loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter Zion. They're still trying to get them to be free. And then, how beautiful, a quote from, we use it in the New Testament, Romans uses it, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messengers who announce peace. Ethiopia's all mountains, isn't it? How beautiful on the mountains are those who bring good news, who announce salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. Then 52 verse 11, depart. This is concluding the first little half of today. I'm not allowed to go yet, but I depart, get out of here. Babylon, touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of it. Go on, purify yourselves. You carry the vessels of Yahweh, you priests. We've got to go home, they try to tell them all. And here's 2 Corinthians 6:17. Come out from them, be separated from them, says the Lord. Touch nothing unclean and I will welcome you. Surely you can see the parallel in the language. Now, what I want to do now is pause for a minute.